I don't ever want legal to like stop someone from taking action.
Hey everyone, I'm Emily Reagan, and you've discovered Unicorns Unite. This is a podcast for freelancers, service providers, virtual assistants, and curious listeners who would like to experience the freedom and flexibility of working virtually. We're the magic makers, movers and shakers, and the real people doing the work behind the scenes of online businesses. Welcome to Unicorns Unite.
But first, this podcast is sponsored by castmagic.io. It's used for podcast, video streamers, and long-form content creators who want to get more mileage out of their content. Sign up for this AI tool and get a free 7-day trial. Just go to get.castmagic.io/unicorns. Hey, 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 welcome back to the show. First of all, thank you for clicking play on the show. I promise this is going to be a great conversation about legal things and how to protect your clients. It is not going to be dry. It is not going to be boring. You are going to leave feeling so smart and being able to guide your clients. First, let me say welcome. If you're new to me, I help virtual assistants become higher paid, highly prized marketing assistants by honing down, niching into marketing services that lend itself to project rates and management positions. If I can help a smart cookie, a smarty pants, combine what they're good at, their passions, their talents, their hobbies, add in online marketing knowledge and marketing strategies that clients expect you to know, you can be off to the races with a very successful service provider freelance business. So this is the podcast for you. Today, we are diving into legal protection for our clients who produce digital courses, memberships, group coaching programs, and are forgetting to do some of the most basic things. Now, I cover some of this inside my signature program, the Unicorn Digital Marketing Assistant School, but we need to have a bigger conversation about refund policies and copyright. That's why I have Autumn Witt Boyd here today. She is a lawyer who has a very fascinating story about how she quit the corporate life and went into her own business. And you're going to be able to extract some goodies and some insight for yourself. Love Autumn so much. She is the owner of AWB Firm, which she started in 2015. She helps some big names like Amy Porterfield, Jasmine Starr, build, protect, and scale their businesses. And we're going to talk about the three different stages of legal protection and how you can help your clients and also protect them from people stealing their work, their courses, and market their programs better so there's not as many refund requests. I think this is really the key here. And what she's teaching us about working in this online sector, you really can apply to your own business. I see a lot of my beginning students get stuck in this startup phase, thinking about all the legal protections they need for themselves. And Autumn really nailed it when she said, where there's low risk, it's okay to start. Don't let the legal part stop you from taking action. We're going to dive into contracts. We're going to dive into privacy policies. We're going to dive into copyright and that little pesky question of the copyright clause in your own service provider contract. All right, let's jump in. Hey, Autumn, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you here helping our marketing assistants help our own clients when it comes to legal protection. A lot of our clients are creating courses and membership sites and digital products. So welcome to the show. Thank you. Tell everyone a little bit about your story, where you live, what life is like, all the good stuff.
Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for having me. I am Autumn Witt Boyd. I'm a lawyer and the founder of the AWB firm. We are a full service law firm. We work with all the people you just mentioned. So most of our clients sell online courses. A lot of them are coaches, consultants, or they may provide services to people in those areas. So like marketing agencies, bookkeeping, that kind of thing. So we operate only in this digital world, which is really fun. I started the firm in 2015, so we are coming up 9 years, which is bananas. It feels like it went by in a blink and then also has been a million years. My background, I was a copyright litigator. So very normal legal career before I started my own thing. I worked for a judge. I worked for a couple different law firms. And I reached the point probably a lot of your listeners reached, which is burnout. I was working all the time. I was traveling a lot. I have twin boys who were born in 2011. So they were getting bigger. When they were babies, it was still hard to work 16, 80 hour weeks, but they didn't really notice when I was still gone. And so as they got older, they noticed more. They were very vocal about me being gone. And my dear husband, who's an amazing co-parent, also was not thrilled with the amount that I was gone. He was very good at keeping all the trains running on time, but it's just not that much fun to solo parent if there might be another option. So
yeah.
We sat down in the end of 2014. I had a big trial that I really wanted to see through to the end for a copyright case. It was very exciting. It was in Philadelphia. I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So I finished that and then looked around, didn't see another job that I was really interested in. And so decided to start my own thing, which was terrifying.
Yes.
I had no grand plan. I never thought that I was going to be an entrepreneur. It was not anything I'd ever been excited about or thought about. It was really kind of a little bit of a desperation move. But when I got into it, I'm a high fact finder. I think that's the Colby.
Yeah.
I just dove right in. It was so much fun learning a totally new skill set. They don't teach marketing and how to run a business and all these things in law school.
Nope.
I was a journalism major undergrad. So also I know. Yes. Also no background in business. So I was just so pleasantly surprised by how much fun it was to learn all these new things and that, I turned out to be okay at it. I initially thought, okay, I'll do this for 3 or 4 months. And if it's a disaster, I can go get a job. And now my husband is a consultant as well. We both have our own businesses and we joke, we are unemployable. Never to have to work for anyone else again.
I'm in the same boat. You can't get me back to a corporate office ever again. Nope.
I know. Yeah. So we've grown little by little over those 9 years. We're now a team of 10. We have 4 attorneys. We're about to bring on a fifth. So we've just kind of grown as our clients have grown. So now we are really lucky and we love working with some of the biggest names your listeners have probably heard of. We work with Amy Porterfield, with Jasmine Starr, Growth Tools, Speaker Lab, lots and lots of the larger players in this area, which they just have things popping up all the time. So it's really fun to see, what's going on behind the scenes and to be able to support them.
Oh my gosh. We're going to get into questions about digital, course protection and all of that. But from almost a freelancer or business owner story, how the heck did you do this, Autumn, and grow this business and secure such big clients? Surely there's some tidbits in there that we could take away for our own businesses, even though you're in a different industry.
Yeah. I mean, hard work and determination is a lot of it. I don't have any special sauce. Your listeners can absolutely do all of the things that I have done. And I've tried lots of different things. So I definitely rely on my network. You probably just saw, I just put up a Facebook post yesterday because I've been traveling a lot and I drive all the sales for the firm. And so I have really not been doing much sales activity, honestly, not much business development. So I just put out a post on Facebook saying, hey, I've been traveling a lot. I'm back. I'm opening up my calendar. I want to start expanding my network. I want to expand my circle, tag in your favorite people who might work with the same kinds of clients that we do. So that I would say if there's one strategy that your listeners could take away that has been really successful for us, it's networking with people who serve your clients in other ways so that they are hearing your ideal clients say oh, I'm having this challenge. And they can say oh, well, you need to call Emily because she is awesome at that. Or you need to call the AWB firm. They helped me with that or they helped someone I know with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of service providers think they just can start a business and hide behind their keyboard and clients will fall in their lap. You are so good at this. I actually screenshotted that post and I shared it with my work group. This is very meta right now. And I was like, look how Autumn did this, guys. Because I'm all about if you can connect with that sister service provider, if the SEO expert can connect with the website designer, who can connect with the email tech person. We all start serving those bigger and more specialized clients who want someone in that lane instead of the person who's trying to do it all. So great job. You're good at it. And I immediately replied with like, oh, you need to know my friend Serena. And like, she has an agency.
And I like made a list and now I will follow up with all those people. And I have now a warm introduction. So now I'm not cold emailing someone.
Yeah.
Now I'm saying, Emily said I should reach out. And like, again, it's not 100%, but probably 95% of people are so happy to get on a call and just see how you can help each other.
Yeah.
Me asking, will you do this for me? It's like my clients need this too. So it is always reciprocal.
Yeah. And even with us, the way it worked out, it was so genuine. You saw some jobs, sent them my way. I've like asked you questions, sent people your way. And so it really is not a salesy, slimy like tactic. It's just, it's genuine helping each other.
And you would do with your friend that like you see at your kid's school or you are in an exercise class with. Like,
yeah,
we'll help people. Yeah.
So how did you carve out this niche though in the online space? So did you know you were going to do online? This is the other part that I think we can extract something for our own business, because we start off a little bit of a generalist specialist, but then, you know, the riches are in the niches, whatever we want to say. And as we specialize, we can charge more. And so you've done that really well, because I know there's lawyers dime a dozen in my hometown, but they don't get online business. I don't even want to talk to them. So fill us in.
Yes, very much by accident. I started out, they call it door law, like you'll take anything that walks in the door. Coming from copyright, I knew I wanted to continue doing IP, but when I started my own firm, I did not want to be in court because that schedule is just really tough, especially with a family. And I had a third kid my second year of running the firm.
Can't forget her.
So I like did a ton of networking locally. We have a big startup community here in Chattanooga. There's a lot of transportation and tech. So I thought that my skill set would be a good fit for what they needed. I did not know, if your listeners have ever tried to work with startups, they know, or if you have, Emily, startups don't want to be slowed down by legal. And often they don't really have a legal budget. So it was a total mismatch. As I was kind of trying to learn how to run a business, I was listening to a lot of podcasts, like Being Boss, Boss Mom. I listened to Amy Porterfield's, like so many of like the OG podcasts. This was like 2015. So I was listening to all these podcasts to learn, and a lot of them had Facebook groups that went along with them. So I would hop into the Facebook group. I would ask questions, and I noticed other people asking questions about legal issues, and there were no other lawyers in there. Like, it was really a true blue ocean. And so I just started answering where I could, being helpful, offering my services if it made sense. And people started hiring me. Like, it was ridiculously easy. Now, I wasn't charging enough, so that was part of why people were hiring me.
Yeah, so we all go through that.
So learned a lot of lessons there, but it was just me and I really had no overhead. So it was an easy time to make mistakes. And I found that I just really liked working with these kinds of businesses. I could do kind of everything they needed. It wasn't hard. It was joyful. It was fun. I liked their personalities. I liked what they were doing. We had a lot of commonalities. So I did not niche down for a long time, though. We still kind of were door law. Those were definitely my favorites. I'm not really a people pleaser, but I like had to go to therapy. This was like 2020 when we finally niched down because we were so busy.
Okay.
Our online clients had absolutely exploded in 2020.
Yep.
We were bananas busy and we were still doing just all these crazy things for all these different people. And we didn't really have a lot of systems and forms because when you're doing different things every day, like it's hard to find any efficiencies. And so I finally was like, okay, like these are our favorite clients. I just have to trust that if we lesson release the ones that aren't in this area, you know, the others will fill in. The thing that helped me, that my therapist helped me do, it's like, it's so obvious, but it never occurred to me. I now have an incredibly robust refer out list. So if you send a potential client to me, I don't just say, no, we can't do that. I say, that's not a great fit for us. Call so-and-so or my friend so-and-so. If they can't help you, they'll know someone who can. So like we had a client just today, literally, who referred one of their employees who's starting a new business and they needed help with a lease. So like we don't do leases because our clients are online, but I was able to still be helpful. And that feels good to me. Like what was terrifying about it was just like saying no, like that feels terrible. Someone's done you a favor of sending someone to you and you're just like, nope. Sorry.
Yeah. This is what I teach my unicorns to do too, because we get to that spot. I mean, that's so relatable and that's so neat to know that you went through that journey. I mean, whenever I get in somebody's business and I'm building their quiz funnel or doing some of their email tech and then they want to bring me on or
One client really loved my graphics and wanted me to design a logo. And I had to say, like, no, this is just not the best use of my time. It's really the premise of the 10X is easier than 2X book. That is it. It's really solid boundaries of what you say yes and no to. I think that's the secret sauce to business.
And every time I go outside my little box, I regret it. And so I have an incredible assistant now who helps me just with the incoming inquiries and making sure everybody's taken care of, because I cannot always be the one to respond to an email quickly.
Yeah.
And she has the biggest heart. And I have to gently say, like, remember the last time we said yes to someone who wasn't a good fit? And like, we all regretted it. So it is a kindness to say no to someone that you are not the best person to help.
Oh my gosh, so good. And I have found having bad cops on my team really helps me. People who will help me stand up for my own boundaries or be that gateway and that shield, because I will just say yes to everybody and then spread myself so thin. So, oh my gosh, this is so helpful to hear that. The online thing too is interesting, because you nailed in, and I see this happening with my own people, and I've kind of had this thought baking about, I talk to a lot of like social media managers as an example. They try to work with the brick and mortars and then they wonder why they quit in 3 months. And there's just something about this online audience that I'm like, they're fun, they're entrepreneurial. When they start making money, it just all works. That's who I target my course for too. And so I love that you kind of found this out going through this research stage, finding out and paying attention to what people needed. I went through my own reiteration without quite the strategic brain that I have now. It just kind of happened.
Well, and it's still evolving. Like, we in the last year or so have really moved from doing kind of one-off projects, like, you need a trademark, we'll do your trademark, to really being more outside general counsel. So That is kind of a shift in everything. But it has helped us identify, like, who are the clients that really like to DIY things? Like, that's great. I have no problem with that. I think that works for a lot of businesses, but that's not who we want to work with, because we want to be a real, you know, legal partner, be an integral part of their team. And so you do get better and your business will evolve. All of your listeners, like, you're not going to be doing the same thing in a year or two that you're doing today. And so sometimes that like vetting or discernment process changes as well.
And it's interesting. You've just learned over time what you'll do. You have to just do it. You have to just try it and realize and pay attention to that moment and create that awareness. Okay, let's get into digital course stuff, because I'm thinking about what you said about startups, and that's where my brain was going, how they don't always realize it's important. A lot of those, I call them the baby clients, like, they're just getting started. Their offer isn't truly vetted. They're not really selling. They're proving the model. They're in that startup stage. And then the next client I call the growth stage, right? And they're the ones who have started making money and now they're really trying to systematize, trying to scale, really become more efficient. It's a little bit of a messy zone. I'm there. It's kind of a lower profit zone too, as you like work stuff out, but you're kind of going back and fixing what you didn't do. So we see this a lot, like clients get started really quickly and then they get their first refund request. And you're like, oh. So let's talk about what we can do to help our clients put some things in place. What do we need to know? What do we need to steer them to? Because you are a sister service provider where we can say, go talk to Autumn, or like, go get these templates. Since a lot of us are working with digital course creators and membership site owners, like, those go hand in hand. So yeah. Let's just jump in.
Okay, perfect. I'm going to remember to do my disclaimer, which is I am a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer unless you've hired a firm.
Yeah.
So this is not legal advice. It's just information. I'll kind of start off with just my and our firm's philosophy about legal protections. And that is, you know, you talked about in that startup phase when you're just figuring out what to do, you're not really making money yet, you're testing offers. The great thing about that phase is that it's very low risk legally, because you're not making a lot of money. You don't have something really valuable that you've created that you know you need to protect and keep other people from copying. It depends on the personality, but I think there can be a tendency, especially if you have like a type A person, to be really worried during that stage that like, oh, I need to go hire a lawyer and I need to protect everything and I need to register all my trademarks and da 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 da. I would encourage folks, if you're listening and that is your tendency, to just like take a deep breath, or if you're, you know, the person you're supporting has that tendency. I don't ever want legal to like stop someone from taking action. So in this phase, when you are lower risk because there's less to lose, there's less to worry about, I recommend starting off with a really solid contract, and that will get you really almost everything you need. We can talk about some other things, but in that initial startup phase, make sure you have a solid contract. We do have templates. Because our firm works with the big players in this field, we see the problems that pop up. And so our contracts are really tailored to, you know, what your business really needs. They don't have a bunch of junk that might apply to a brick and mortar, but not you. That is kind of step one. And then as you get into that growth phase, now things are getting a little more complicated. Like hopefully you're making some money. You're starting to figure out what works. Maybe you have a program or a course with a catchy name that you've run a couple times. So like, you know, people like it and you probably want to stick with it. That's when it comes time to think about up-leveling, maybe hiring a lawyer to do a custom contract. If you have areas where either you don't really understand the template or you're getting a lot of questions or you feel like you just do something kind of weird and so it doesn't fit, then it might be time to engage with a lawyer. But again, 9 out of 10 times when a potential client comes to us, we start with their contract, even an Amy Porterfield or, you know, a larger business.
So when you say contract, though, what does that mean with a course creator? Is this terms of sale? Like, what is a contract? I'm thinking of all the different, you know, a lot of us have our service provider hat on and we're thinking, oh, the client services agreement that we're making. But what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So for your service providers, it would be your client contract. So that one-on-one agreement. Yeah. But for a course creator or a coach with maybe a group program, it's going to be what we call terms of use, typically.
Okay.
People don't think of it as a contract because
no, I didn't.
Checking the box and scrolling the box, you know, maybe scrolling or it's linked, but no one ever looks at it. But that is a binding contract between the course business, the provider of the course or coaching services, and the customer. It becomes really important if you get a refund request or if you have, you know, somebody who's acting up in your community or any of the other millions of things that can go wrong.
Okay. So would this be different too? Like, I've seen other specialty contracts when checking out for masterminds, affiliates, and all of that. We call that a contract.
Yep. They're all okay. Contracts. And they're going to be a little different. Like a mastermind may have some different terms, but it's still the basic.
Okay.
You want to say, what are you getting? What are you paying?
Yeah.
Cancel. What's the refund policy? You know, all those things should be.
Okay. What about at that scaling level where, you know, you name drop some names where some of those people are at? Like, what do they need at that level?
So then we start to look at more complex protections. We look at their corporate entity structure. So are they a corporation or an LLC? Maybe we add an IP holding company or some related entities. That is not something most of your
No, like head spinning. But no, it's good to know what will come next, you know? And then it also tells us, like you said, calms us down. What do we need to focus on now? Because I see a lot of my own students get really stuck in just even starting an LLC. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you can go ahead and start like doing some client work without that. Like, you'll be okay.
Yes. Again, most of the service providers online, I mean, there will be a point where an LLC or a corporation probably makes sense, but one lawyer's opinion, I don't think you need it to get started.
Good.
I never want that fear to stop someone from just getting started.
Well, I'm so glad because I say the same thing. So, okay, that's nice to know about that next level stage. But for most of us, like in this growth stage is when we need Autumn, when we need a lawyer on our team to help us. So what other types of contracts or protection do we need or do we need to be thinking of?
Yeah. So again, this is kind of next level. You've got a solid contract in place. I start looking at your intellectual property protections. So again, for a service provider, this is not as important, but for an online course or a big coaching company that probably has a curriculum that they're using, usually that intellectual property in that course or program is really the core of their business. Like that's what the value is. I am a copyright lawyer by background, so I sometimes joke that I'm a copyright evangelist. And no one talks about copyright in the online world. There's a lot of talk about trademark. But copyright is what will protect all the bits and pieces of your course or your coaching program. So videos, workbooks, templates, all of the resources that you share with your students or that you use to teach them or to guide them. Maybe you license it to them to allow them to use with their customers or their clients. All of that is protected by copyright law in the United States. And so we can register that with the United States Copyright Office to give a little boost, a little bit of extra protection. So that is one of those next level protections.
So is just putting a little C mark at the bottom of my Google Doc, does that mean it's copyrighted?
So it is protected by copyright, but our copyright system is weird. In the United States, you can't file a lawsuit until it's registered.
Mm.
So it's protected, but you can't really do anything to enforce those rights. So that is kind of the carrot that the law gives. You get some extra benefits if you register in addition to being able to file a lawsuit. So
okay,
it's not what, required, but if you want to enforce your rights, it basically is.
Yeah. And that's probably where people get really in that sweaty position where someone has stolen their curriculum. I mean, we're seeing that happening a lot still. I'm seeing it happening with content as well. So I do want to mention that, but yeah. How long does that registration process take? Because this is motivating somebody to like go ahead and do it now. So you could take swift legal action when somebody does copy your client's course.
The process can take 6 to 9 months, but now this is copyright. Trademark is different. But under copyright law, they'll backdate the registration to the date you file all the paperwork. So even if it takes 9 months, whatever the date that you send in all the paperwork, that's the date of your registration.
Okay. Okay. So what kind of protection do you have if you don't actually register it?
So you have all the same protections, but if you find someone has copied your work, you can't actually sue them. Does that make sense? Like you theoretically have the rights.
Does the date matter when they copied you?
Yes, the date is very important because if you register your work before someone copies you, you get a lot more benefits if you have to sue them. So you can get your attorney's fees, you can get much higher damages, up to $150,000 per work, even if you can't prove that like your business was harmed. Otherwise, you have to prove your business was harmed. Here's the amount that I lost. Statutory damages. So I actually just settled a case recently. And if it's a statutory damages case, that settlement number is much larger.
Well, like you're
a much bigger hammer if you find that someone has copied you.
I like that analogy. I just saw like a version of Thor like in my head with his like giant hammer.
A copyright registration.
Oh my gosh.
Gives you. Yeah.
So what's happening out there with courses that are being stolen? Like, I mean, this has always been a thing. I mean, I think I told you when we first met and did our coffee chat, somebody had taken my name. That was a trademark, of course.
Yeah.
But it's scary out there.
So the tricky thing with courses is that usually we don't see what I would call verbatim copying, where it's like they actually take your course and sell it. Usually it's they're taking your ideas, they're reworking it. So they're making their own slides, they're doing their own videos, they have their own templates or handouts or whatever. And that is really hard to recover any kind of damages for, because it's hard to prove where did they find it. You know, so much of what we teach, even though we are all special and we all have our own special way of teaching and explaining things, a lot of these concepts are really common. You know, even if you have a 7-step framework to do XYZ, you know, you can probably find something similar that someone else has done. I would say most of the time when clients come to us with a problem and they say someone's copied me, and then I look at it, and if you kind of put them side by side, if they're not almost the same, it's really hard to win.
Okay.
Our copyright law is just not really set up to address that issue.
What if that person had gone through their training? Does that give you a little bit more power?
It can, because you can put things in your contract that prohibit people from using your stuff, that potentially you could kick them out, or you could, you know, have other things that you could do to take action against them. It is imperfect, though, because copyright does not protect ideas. It only protects like the exact way you express an idea. So like the exact slides or the exact videos, the exact template or handout.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. It's such a weird world because I feel like I'll come up with titles and things and ideas, but they're not protectable. I already know that, but I'm seeing even more. The whole unicorn thing, like people were starting to copy that, like my course title. I've seen a lot of marketing coaches, which is why I tried to add the unicorn thing in there so I could kind of distinguish myself. But it's such a crazy world. And I think, well, from what I'm hearing from you, is there some of it we just can't do anything about?
Yeah. And I know it sucks when someone copies you, especially if it's someone you know or someone who went through your course or someone who used to be on your team. Like, it's usually not a stranger. It is almost always when we get these issues, it's usually someone who was kind of in your orbit.
Oh.
It's hurtful. It feels like someone has stolen your baby. So I don't want to minimize that. Like, it's awful. But I try to encourage my clients when we look at the like cost benefit of taking action. Is it really harming your business? Are they really stealing your customers? And usually the answer is no.
Like,
it just feels bad. Usually it's someone who is not as good as you, not as far along, does not have their own ideas, does not have your expertise. And I also find in our, especially in our world where we have so many personal brands, people are really hiring you because they want to learn from you or they want to work with you. They want to be in your world. I encourage people to remember that, like, they have that, you know, I have a friend who calls it Jenny juice. Like, you've got that special sauce in your business and with your content and your products that no one can really copy, even if they're copying some of that underlying ideas.
I love what you just said. And I think that all of us marketing assistants can extract Autumn's words and reflect that back at our client, because you're going to be in that boat with the copycats. With our friend Brenna McGowan, I saw somebody take her 5 steps for pre-launch and just like rewrite it just a little bit. I mean, that's what AI can do. It can make it so easy. I can go in and grab videos, RSS feeds, and it doesn't seem like that. But you know what was interesting? I believe in karma. I'm not super woo, but I've seen some cancel culture happening and like people are quick to defend.
If you have a loyal audience, loyal followers.
Yeah.
I'm not about that. They're not going to be just like, go follow someone else just because it's some.
Yeah, they're going to let you know. And I think that's okay. Okay. The big thing I come across with my clients is the refund request and this whole dunning process. Oh my gosh, it's so laborious. So what advice can you give us for setting up our clients to make that less painful? And it actually can end up costing us money, right? Help us out with that. Okay, time out. I'm interrupting my own show to tell you about a new favorite tool. You already know that I'm all about being the best digital marketing assistant or specialist out there, and that means staying up to date with the latest AI tools and marketing strategies. Especially if you're doing project rates and retainers, you want to work faster and you always want to impress your clients at the same time. So it's a win-win, slay all day type of cliche, but it's true. So I want to tell you about my sponsor, castmagic.io. If you help your clients with podcasts, live streams, courses, memberships, summits, YouTube, any kind of video, then you want to use this tool. We had a demo recently in our digital marketers work group and it blew everyone's mind. We all loved it because you can get so much content out of it. Transcripts, show notes, social posts, emails, even create support docs, quizzes, and assessments. You can even clip videos. It's amazing. And then it goes a step further and it allows you to templatize it so it gets even faster and you get more efficient. Me and my team are using Cast Magic and they have usage-based pricing, meaning there's a plan for everyone depending on how many minutes you really need and the content you're working with. You can use my link in the show notes or go to get.castmagic.io/unicorns to start automating your content workflow. Again, that's get.castmagic.io/unicorns. All right, back to the show.
I'm a little bit of a broken record, but strong contract. So make sure that you have one. Make sure if you do have terms of use that the people who are buying from you actually have to like check a box.
Okay.
That they agree. So we want like proof of the contract and clear refund policy. Then some of it is really more business. That's not advice at all, but just kind of recommendations, which is if you've got really important policies or procedures that you follow in delivering your course or your program, make sure that you talk about that during the sales process. So we help our clients with a lot of refund requests for, you know, high dollar programs, $50,000, $100,000.
Oh, gosh.
Almost every refund request is, I didn't get what I thought I was going to get, or this is different than you told me it would be. And so just being really clear, this is the kind of support you're going to get, or this is what's included, or I will give you 4 weeks to check this out and you can ask for a refund then. But after that, like, I'm sorry, you're in. So just being really clear in however you're selling, webinar, emails, on the sales page, on the checkout page, that those important things are highlighted. Because unfortunately, even though the contract will hold up, most people are not going to read it. It's hard to, I mean, and I've done this, you know, someone asks for a refund and you say, well, per the contract, da, 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 da. And they're like, where did you even get that contract? Like, I never saw that.
Yeah. Well, then we get into a funny world too with PayPal and people can just request their money. Yes. Can we do anything about that?
Yeah. So I will say most of the payment processors tend to side with the customer more. Mm-hmm. So just kind of know that going in that you may want to budget for a little bit of a kind of default rate. But if you have solid evidence, you know, you've got your contract, you can show they agreed to it. If it is some sort of online course or coaching program, you can show they logged in 72 times. They took this many quizzes. They provided me with this many pieces of content for feedback. I had 7 coaching calls and I have recordings of those. Like all of that evidence showing that you did provide services. It's not just like you stole their credit card and charged it. I mean, this is like a legitimate business relationship. The more you can show that, the more you're likely, again, it's not 100%, but you're likely to be able to overcome a chargeback.
First of all, I have to say I'm very lucky. I've never had someone ask for a refund.
I'm knocking on wood for you.
Knocking. I've never had someone ask for a refund because the course wasn't what they thought it was. But I have had a few wackadoodles. And yeah, I have had...
There's always going to be those. Like, yeah. I don't know a way to prevent that. People are going to people.
I'm lucky there. I've had some people have something happen or... Right. Change their mind that, you know what, I actually don't want this. And I'm usually pretty cool about those situations because if I'm not going to refer you, if you're not going to be good at this, I'm kind of okay with that. But I can't picture what that would look like with any kind of scale.
That works well.
In yeah.
Smaller business. It is tricky at scale. For a lot of our businesses that are larger, well, A, if you keep your customers happy, you have very few refund requests. So that's my other like piece of business recommendation. Like, we have some clients that have a lot of refund requests and we have some that have very few. And if you look at the businesses, you can kind of see a difference. So customer service is really important. Doing the things that you promised you would do during the sales process is really important. And then I would say most of our clients have a default rate built into their budget. So they know that, I mean, it can be as large as 5% just between like phone payments and refund requests, you know, change of mind. And then they have to kind of decide based on their business values. Some of them literally do just like, if you don't like it, I'm going to give you a refund. Like, I don't care. And they're cool with that.
Yeah.
Others, I think with the really high touch services, like a really high-end mastermind or something like that, that can get tricky because it can sometimes spread like wildfire. Like one person has buyer's remorse and then they talk to their friend and they're like, yeah, I'm not so sure I'm getting value from this either. And now you're out $500,000.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That is not okay. So I think you have to kind of deal with it case by case. You know, if it's a $100 course or, you know, a little PDF ebook, that's different than, you know, a $50,000 mastermind. But I think most of my clients that are the most successful really, you know, try to be accommodating when they can, but also stick to their guns when it's clear someone's just trying to take advantage of them.
Well, that's the crazy situations I've been in with just a couple. But there was that one student who you could tell back when I had kind of more of an evergreen course, bought and was going through as fast as possible during the
for the refund period. Mm-hmm.
And you could see like this is not a normal rate of student progress. I think she did a PayPal chargeback. I was able to show that. But it's crazy to me that somebody would do that. But I also don't want to attract those type of people.
I do always say too, with the refund policies, you know, if you've got a 30-day money back guarantee or whatever, you know, that's a marketing tool. Mm-hmm. But then it also may have a business cost. You know, you will get some refund requests if you have a money back guarantee. So there's pros and cons to everything. But you have to make sure that you're, you know, getting enough additional sales from having that as a feature to make up for the refund requests that you just will get for sure.
Yeah, because I know that's big in Amy Porterfield's Digital Course Academy is teaching everyone to have some kind of refund policy or guarantee. And Alex Hormozi, he's really big into that with these crazy guarantees that I'm like, actually, no, I need to protect myself. I have learned that I know that if my students watch the first module and then get to module 2, they will know is if this is the right program right. for them. So what I have done is kind of made that the 14-week mark. And I don't drop bonuses until after that. Like I don't give them access to anything until they watch it.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things you can do to protect yourself. Dripping content is one of them for sure.
Okay.
And then the other thing is, you know, if you've got payment plans, just kind of know that you're probably not going to get paid. Like, it's very hard to chase payment if someone has quit a program or if you've had to kick them out for some reason. So at that point, I usually advise like that is lost money. It's not usually worth pursuing. Now, you can choose to grant or deny a refund at that point and hopefully at least kind of cut your losses.
Does anyone ever go to court over things like that? Or is that just kind of a bless and release situation?
It can. We actually have one lawsuit right now with a client with a refund request. I would say it's rare. Short of taking someone to collections, there's companies like Gravy, which you've probably heard of, which is it like a Kinder Collections?
Yeah.
they are really kind of an extension of your customer service team, where they're trying to keep people engaged, keep people paying.
Yeah, because sometimes it really is somebody just needed to update a credit card. I lose those suckers all the time.
Yeah, they need an extra month. You may be able to work with them so that it's not a total loss. Even if you do have to part ways, that you can do that in a way that hopefully retains your credibility, that they're not bashing you all over the internet. Like, that's where I see real damage happen. Oh. Where sometimes someone feels like they weren't taken care of, or like they weren't treated with respect during, you know, if they have an issue. That can, again, lead to that spreading like wildfire.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Then you have damage control with that. Well, is there anything within the refund policy that we should add that we might not be thinking about?
Yeah, have one. So a lot of people, yeah. We ask all of our clients when we're drafting terms or contracts, you know, what is your refund policy? And a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, I don't give refunds. And I'm like, okay, well, that's your policy then. But we have to say that. So making sure it's really clear. And then there are actually, I think no one talks about this, so I'll talk about it. There are rules, federal regulations from the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, around using words like money back guarantee, or pretty much around guarantees. So if you are using that kind of language, just be aware that there are rules around that. You have to make it really clear. Are there conditions on that money back guarantee? If there are, you have to tell people that from wherever you're talking about the guarantee, you have to make it really clear if there's any hoops they have to jump through or anything like that.
Okay.
So I would just caution people. And again, when you're starting out, when you're smaller, you're not going to be on the FTC's radar. But some of your listeners may be working with clients who are at scale, where, you know, we are seeing the FTC start to come after, especially like business coaches who are making these big promises of earn money while you sleep and make $1 million tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll make $50,000 or we'll give you your money back. Like those kinds of things. They are starting to pay more attention to those because there's been a huge increase since the pandemic in those kinds of, and there's a lot of fraud out there. Like hopefully none of our listeners are working.
No, that's not my audience. But, you know, I mean, every now and then there's a sticky situation where I have a unicorn working with somebody who's kind of pushing them in a direction. And I think this is the fun place I'm at when I get to talk to different service providers. But I can think of somebody whose client asked her to literally steal somebody else's content. And you're like, okay, well, like, yeah, that's a solid no. I think I need to move on. But I'm glad you talked about the income claim, because I had just written down disclaimers. Like, let's talk about that, because some of us are working with those coaches that are promising money. What do we need to do to protect ourselves when it comes to that?
Yes. So this is an area that is not a DIY area. So that's kind of first. I would say if you're at any kind of scale, mid six figures, seven figures, this is an area. If you are making income claims, you need to be working with a lawyer, like full stop.
Define an income claim first, though.
So it could be in a testimonial, or it could be just straight up like you will make X. So it might be like consider a sales page, you know, Sarah P. took our program and in 3 weeks, she made $500,000, or she increased her email list by 1,000%. Any of those like increase in numbers, or you will earn X dollars. And testimonials count too, because they're basically giving the impression that this is, I know, this is something a lot of people do wrong. So I'm on my soapbox a little bit here.
No, I mean, we need to hear this. And I felt like I was doing okay because I wasn't making high income claims. But even saying how Stephanie C. made $2,000 a month as a stay-at-home mom, it still counts.
Yes. So I'll give you the broad brushstrokes. But again, everybody uses their income claims a little differently. So there's not like a black and white answer. We review our client sales pages and work with them on making sure that they're compliant. But general broad strokes is if you're making an income claim, first of all, it has to be true. Like you have to be able to substantiate it. So Stephanie C. has to be a real person.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yes. And so hopefully that is like table stakes. Like that should not be a hard thing to do. And then you also have to show that it is typical. It doesn't have to be like an exact average of what your students or your customers' results are, but it should be like in the range of normal. Again, there's no like black and white answer there. But what a lot of people are not doing, so this is kind of a first recommendation to think about, is just start tracking your customers' success so that you can say like, is $2,000 a month normal or not? Or is that an outlier? Because you can still use outliers in your marketing. You just have to tell people they're an outlier. So you have to say, you see this a lot with weight loss claims too, you know, results not typical. And then it'll say like all, you know, Stephanie was at the gym 7 times a week and ate 300 calories and da-da-da-da. Had no children and slept 12 hours a day all the time.
Yeah, not normal at all. She is a robot. What I just heard from Mia from a marketing standpoint was like, dang, we're already cutting it close when it comes to like getting our sales pages out there. But now we need to have a lawyer look it over. Like, oh my God, back that up.
Like, go to the proportionality. This is a risk that becomes more serious as you scale. I don't mean ignore it, but I mean, lawyers give advice, especially with these areas. There's always a fine line between how much can I do to stay compliant and then also successfully market my thing. A little gray area there.
You know who you need to network with is the copywriters, because they're the ones writing these sales pages. And you're like, I already know this, Emily. But I'm like, oh my gosh, none of the copywriters I've ever worked with have...
They want to slow their clients down.
No, they don't. But no one has ever been like, this testimonial is very clearly an outlier. I'm already thinking of a couple, and I know they are, and I'm not trying to do anything shady, but like somebody outside might look at that wrong. And that isn't a normal size contract. That's somebody who's been doing it a few years. So
I'll tell you like where we see this come up, like what is the reality of where this is a problem is often in the context of refund requests. So somebody makes a refund request, you say no, they get mad. They file a complaint with the FTC or with your state attorney general, and then they can open an audit or an investigation into all the practices. And now all of a sudden, all the things that were working just fine had never been a problem are kind of under the microscope.
Oh, okay. I have heard little birdies talking about certain people in our industry. And now I'm like, I really want the tea. But oh my gosh. Yeah, I never thought about that. That's how it would start, because people are results not typical.
If you're doing a good job, if you have happy customers, if you're giving them what you promised, you're probably not going to have these issues.
All right. So my little logistical brain here is wondering how you would organize that customer success tracker. Have you seen one, and what does it look like?
I have seen a couple. It can be as simple as an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay.
It does not have to be fancy. It could also be like a Google form that you ask people to fill out once a month or whatever. Or I have also seen like very fancy platforms that are built in. Like if someone builds like a custom course platform, that can
okay.
that. So I've also seen, like I have a client, there's a thread in their Facebook group where everyone like on Monday has to report their success. So they're not necessarily like tracking it in a document, but they can go back and grab it, if that makes sense.
It's almost like setting yourself up for an audit to be like, this is it. Because I'll tell you, I mean, let's be real, gathering the testimonials, the social proof, like I can't even get my team to drop things in the right folder sometimes. Let alone like we're trying to track which business owner hired which unicorn. And I'm like, this is all like extra, you know, it's not like making me money. So it gets like forgotten.
Start with like the easiest.
Okay. So while I have you, I want to ask you about copyright, since this is your jam. When it comes to us as the contractor, sometimes we're creating content for our clients and, you know, making graphics, writing copy. Talk to me a little bit about the copyright for our own business.
Yes. So again, this is in the US. The rule is if an employee, like a W-2 employee, is creating something for a business and it's part of their normal job duties, then the business owns it. And that's automatic. You don't have to transfer it. That's what we call work for hire. The default rule, if you're a contractor, is the opposite. So the default rule is that the contractor owns all of the, you know, whatever they're creating. Now you can change that by contract.
Yes.
But it has to be in writing. It has to be signed. Really, an email doesn't really work. Like it needs to be transferred in a formal document. So that's something to consider in your client contracts. You tell me, but I don't see any reason for the copywriter to retain the copyright. Like if they're going to use it again. But I will say, and our template includes this for service providers, I like to put something in there that the copyright transfers only upon payment in full.
Yes.
So you can hold it hostage.
Yes.
An important little kind of nugget to have. If you
Does that count for our websites? Because that's probably where I see the most drama is the website projects that run long or don't get paid in full. And I've heard of websites being held hostage.
Yeah. Yeah. Being on the other side, I'm like, oh, I hate that, but I get it.
But yeah, if somebody didn't pay, yeah.
Okay. And then I was almost wondering, why does it matter? And I think as the client, I want my stuff if you made it personal. But as I had DM'd you a few weeks ago, you can see situations where clients are trying to use our stuff to make extra money or sell things we didn't quite agree to. And I feel like there's a little blurred area. Do you feel comfortable talking about that just like a tiny bit?
Yeah. It matters. Depending on the situation, it may or may not matter.
Right.
I always give the example. I used to, in my last job when I was filing lawsuits for copyright infringement, I was usually working with photographers. They did stock photography. They cared very much about their copyrights because that's how they made money. But then I will talk to like a portrait photographer or even for like our law firm photos that we just did. The photographers always want to hold the copyright and I will always negotiate because it drives me crazy because I want to own it as the person who's using the photos. I want to be able to do whatever I want. Yes. Well, and it's me. Yes. But I want to be able to, if I include it in a book, I want to be able to register the copyright, which I can't do if I don't own the photo. I don't own the copyright. So it is important if you're using things in your business, you know, if you want to register a course and it has all these images in it and you don't own the copyright, you have to exclude those. So if someone copies that photo, again, I don't know how important it is in the big scheme, but I just like every business asset I want to own. And I will sometimes ask the photographers, like, why do you want to own this copyright? Are you going to license it? I'm not okay with that. I'm licensing my face to a billboard for who knows what. And so I think it is a little bit of just kind of an industry standard for photographers that they kind of preach, you know, always own the copyright. And I'm always like, if you want to charge me a little more, that's fine.
Yeah.
I do get that there's value there. But I think the idea that, you know, oh, you need to hold on to it. It's so valuable.
I had a photographer who just was like, all right, here's your photos. And now you have to tag me every time you use them. I can't remember to feed my kids some days. Like, how am I going to remember, like, in on the fly when I'm posting at the bus stop, like, to tag you? And I'm like,
I will pay you $500 more.
To leave me alone. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I didn't think about that. And I don't really see that problem, but it's good to talk about and kind of have that awareness.
If I really want to work with a photographer and they really won't budge, I will just say, okay, well, I just want an exclusive license. I'm the only one who can use it. Like, even the photographer can't use it.
Yeah.
So it basically gives me almost the same thing as ownership.
Okay. Well, where I feel a little funky is I have a client I worked with a long time ago who made a lot of money, and I have a lot of her stuff on my Canva. And it was stuff I created with her ideas, and I might have rewritten and organized. And one of them is like, you know, how to become a millionaire. And it's like the steps. I mean, I'm just going to delete it. Like, obviously, I'd never sell it, but it feels weird. Like, I have it.
Yeah.
I made it. It's a weird, like, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, it depends on your contract.
Yeah.
To your question earlier, like, let's say she hired you to do X and you did X, you created the slide deck or you made the sales page or whatever she hired you to do. And then she turns that into something else. If she owns all of the copyright, she can do that. That's called a derivative work. So, like, she has full control. She can do whatever she wants with it.
Okay.
But you can also put in your contract, I will create a sales page for you. You can use it as a sales page. You can't use it for anything else.
You can't use it as a template.
Yes, exactly. You can't now, like, sell it to somebody else. But that's something maybe to think about as you're entering into relationships. If you think you might be creating an asset that could be used in different ways.
And I mean, it's usually not the outcome, but again, this is fun to talk about and, like, think about it. And now I have the word derivative work. So thank you. I didn't know that. So, okay, before we wrap this up, would you tell me what kind of contract templates you have in your shop so we can open our ears and eyes when our clients are in this mess? Because I know I went on a hunt for an affiliate partnership contract a while ago, and it was just so hard to find one in the online space. But, like, you don't think about it until you maybe see someone else use it. You're like, oh, dang, I need to be doing that. So walk through some of your best-selling top contracts, what we need for online business.
Yes. So we have over 30 templates. So almost anything you can think of. I would say once we get three or four clients asking for the same thing, we're like, let's make a template. So we cover all the basics. Our bestseller is our website privacy policy and terms and conditions. It's a bundle. So that is just required for no matter where you are, you need a privacy policy.
Yeah. GDPR, you just have to do it, you guys.
Yeah. Even if you're not working anywhere outside the US, if you're traffic from California, you need one.
California.
So that is required. That's a good one. And then we have all different versions of client contracts. So for your copywriters or creatives. We have like a creative services, and it's really robust because it includes all these different things that we've seen go wrong. We also have coaching contracts. We have a couple different versions. We have a business one. We have a life, health and wellness one. And then we have online course, group program, any kind of situation where you're working with customers or clients. We have a contract for that. So that's okay. The first one that I would recommend looking at. And okay. Like you said, if you're doing other things, if you have a podcast, we have a podcast guest contract, which is still not totally used everywhere, but yeah, is a good practice, especially if you have a big podcast.
Tell everyone about that one, because I think that's overlooked, about basically agreeing that I can use your image, right?
Yes. Use the image, use the audio, that you can edit it any way you want, that you don't have to get my approval. If I get mad because I don't like it, too bad. It could even be as broad as like, if you wanted to turn this podcast into an online course, you could. That can kind of depend on how much you want to ask for. So there's that guest speaker. So if you have a group program and you bring people in to be a guest speaker, we have a contract for that. And then also, if you are a person who speaks at events, like you're a paid speaker, we have a different version that's for live speaking.
Is that something I would bring my contract to? Because last time I did that, they gave me theirs. I didn't even think about it.
It depends. Okay. So some of the larger events will have their standard agreement that they want you to use. But if you're speaking at one-off, like if you're doing corporate speaking engagements or you're speaking at smaller conferences, they may not have their agreement. We actually had one client who I will not name by name, but is a large client. And we went through this period where she sent us like 5 or 10 of these speaker agreement contracts that other people had asked her to sign. And they were all awful. Like they were just
believe it.
Frankenstein together. Some of them didn't even make sense. They didn't have the terms that were needed. They had a bunch of garbage. And we spent so much time and her money editing them. Just be like, don't agree to this. Don't agree to this.
Yeah.
Add this. Then I finally said, I think you have enough leverage that we should make you a custom speaker agreement. So she's not using our template. We created one that's just for her. So now like she takes that and she's like, if you want me to speak, this is my deal.
Good. I love that level.
Depends on, you know, who you are and where you're speaking.
Goals.
Yes. But I will say, like, a lot of smaller events won't even have an agreement at all because,
yeah,
you know, that you may be the only person they're hiring for keynote or something. So
I see summits. Summits are also something where I do see people doing a decent job with a speaker contract.
If you do a live event, we have like a live event waiver and release. So if someone breaks their ankle or gets too drunk and does something silly, all the kind of, it protects the business from anything like that. We had a couple for COVID, but those are kind of moot now.
Okay.
Thankfully, almost anything that comes up other than the things we don't have are the things that are really custom. So like if you want to do a certification program, that's really custom. We don't have a template for that. Or if you want to like buy someone's business, we don't have a template for that. But most of the basic things that you're going to do day in, day out, we have a template for.
And do you do licensing? Is that part of your services or do you refer out for that?
No, we do licensing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you just touch on that just a hair, just so I can put that little seed in someone's brain for their client?
Licensing just means giving someone else permission to use your intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So that could be you're letting them use your course with their employees. You could license to corporate. You could have it as part of a certification program where you're letting the people you certify use your materials. It could be white labeling, like you could allow someone else to resell your stuff and put their brand on it. So there's lots of different ways that it can work. And we see it a lot in physical products. So if you think of like, I was just trying to find my kid Hello Kitty items for her Easter basket, all that stuff is licensed. Like Hello Kitty or Sanrio is not manufacturing it. They license it to a manufacturer.
Oh, okay. That's a good example.
We're normally doing physical products. NFL products, like any kind of the really big brands will do licensing.
Oh, that's my kid. He's so into football cards right now. And it's like such a thing.
The money maker for, especially as your business grows and you have a lot of value in your IP.
Yeah. And I licensed and augmented my course with an AI training. And I was like, this person's so good at it. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. Let me just add her training into my curriculum. And so it's a nice deal for her because every month I pay her, I'm doing a payment plan. So she gets like some money from me for doing the behind the scenes work and I'm doing all the marketing and it's a really nice thing. It's somewhere I would like to go with my business too. So,
well, and we license our contract templates. So like we're in some courses, like Amy Porterfield has one of our templates as part of Digital Course Academy, other clients who white label them or just provide them, you know, as part of their suite of offerings.
So. Well, I might need to talk to you about that because I probably need to update mine from the previous lawyer I was working with. So
we can chat.
Yeah, you and I have a lot to chat.
Yeah, it's like you provide the thing and the other person is the marketing. So it's a win-win.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah. You and I will chat more later after all of this. Because I'm like, ooh, I need to do this. I need to do that. So this has been such a pleasure.
We have a to-do list.
Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, gosh, so many burning fires. But we're going to link to your contract template, your shop here in the show notes. So you all go take a look, take a peek, get yourself familiar with all of that. Because the best thing you can do is educate your client a little bit and then give them the resource of where to go do it themselves and find the specialist to work with.
Don't try to tell your client what to do. You are not a lawyer, but you can do what we call issue spotting. Yeah.
Most of the time, they just don't even know and they appreciate your insight, like the whole GDPR privacy policy. Like people just aren't doing it. Terms. How many times have I done a sales page and I'm like, okay, where are your terms? And they're just like staring at me. I'm like, oh God. Now I'm going to add like income disclaimer. So, okay, Autumn, this is so fun. Where's the best place to connect with you?
Our website is the hub for all the things, the contracts, our one-on-one services. So that's awbfirm.com. And then we're awbfirm on all the socials. So I spend the most time probably on Facebook and Instagram. So come say hello.
Yeah.
But the store is all on awbfirm.com. And I will plug, we have an incredible email newsletter. So if you want to stay in the loop, sometimes we do promotions on the contracts. And then we are always sending out tips and tricks and trends that we're seeing. We just rebranded it as the CEO Legal Brief. So,
ooh, I like that.
Great for service providers like your listeners and also their clients would probably enjoy it as they're starting to level up.
Yeah, because we're expected to be in the know about everything and it's just like too much. So get on that newsletter. You also have a freebie for us too. I think you have a legal report, right?
Just go on our website and you can grab it right there.
Okay, I have two thunder round lightning flash questions. One, how are you using AI in your business right now?
Not too much. I use it mostly. I'm not super creative. Like I used it yesterday. A former employee asked me to write a letter of recommendation. And so I just typed in like, here's all the awesome things she did. Write me a letter of recommendation. And like I edited it.
Yeah.
Or like I write a lot of thank you notes. And sometimes I feel like I'm writing the same thing, like for referrals. Mm. I'm like, I just sent this person a thank you note. I need to say something different. So I'll ask ChatGPT, like, give me 10 different versions of how to say thank you.
Oh, I like that. That's very tangible. I like that tip. Okay. My other quick question is, what do you put on your client intake form? Like, what's your number one question? Something that we could scrape from and use for ourselves too.
Ours is kind of long. And so if someone fusses about it, we're like, not a fit.
There you go. That's a tactic.
One of my favorites is we ask, what was your biggest win that you're celebrating from the last year in business?
I like that.
Kind of like something fun. And it usually gives us insight, like what they've been working on. And in addition to, usually they're talking about like, I'm going to do this thing and I need help with that. But
yeah,
a little insight.
Oh, that's a good one. No one's ever come up with that one before. I like that. And it's just like setting a good mood, a celebratory mood. Awesome. And then you can kind of see where they're going too, like, and how you can like 10X that. So, okay. Thanks, Autumn. We will catch you over on Instagram and Facebook.
This was so fun. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Just to recap. Big highlights for me, that customer success tracker. Implement that right away with your clients. I know we are going to try to do a better job, but I never, never, never want to be only promoting the outliers. I really try not to, but I'm definitely going to do that to protect myself. Budgeting in that 5% for a default rate. I know we're like, oh man, she made six figures in her launch, but you don't see that most people are. I was even told to do 10, budgeting that in to be able to cover your chargebacks. Because you don't want to go, you know, buy that expensive ski vacation and then actually owe money. Now, this hasn't been a problem for me, thank God, but I have seen this happen with clients and I've heard a lot of horror stories of friends and business peers. My other big takeaway is file the copyright registration of your intellectual property. If it's a course that's selling well, you're out of the startup phase, get your client to do this because you just never, never know. You're really setting them up to get to that scale level and doing the groundwork there. But I think that's so important. And always think, what contract are we missing? Go check out Autumn's contract shop. We'll link to that below. All right. Thanks for getting through this episode. I know it was a long one, but I think it was really important. And I think you're going to feel so good about it when you get in that situation where you're kind of staking a claim in your own boundaries, what you'll do, what you'll not do, and making sure that your client has a solid resource to go to. Next week in the show, we're going to take a little turn and talk about marketing and operations. This is going to be a fun conversation. Stay tuned. While you're here, hit 5 stars. Let me know on Instagram what you thought. Send us a DM. Tag AWB Firm. Tag Autumn on Instagram and me. We'd love to hear your feedback. Keeps us going. Please tell us we did a good job, because this was probably an episode not a lot of people are going to like be attracted to, but you know, my smart cookies are going to get it. You get it. All right. I'll see you in the next episode.
If you want to start earning income as a digital marketing service provider or digital marketing assistant, you only need your laptop. You can tap into what online business owners really need help with by downloading my top 10 most requested tasks. These are the services I did for years for my clients behind the scenes. You can take this download and apply it to your own business and start by offering these very same services. If you want to niche down in digital marketing, this is your guide. Just use the link in the show notes or go to emilyreaganpr.com/services.
Good for you. I'm going to cough too. Cough break.
Yeah. Probably.
Is that you? Is that your siren? Okay. Hang on 1 second.
Sorry.